You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey everyone, Chris Webster here, co-founder of the Archaeology Podcast Network. And as we take a break this holiday season, we're going to bring you episodes from other great shows on the APN that you might not be aware of. One that started just this summer is called Archaeo Book Club. It's hosted by Ash, Tilly, and Judith. Ash and Tilly are also on the And My Trial podcast, and Tilly is on the Tea Break Archaeology podcast. So check out this podcast. They kind of come in pairs throughout the month, and this is episode one, so you can get an idea of what they're talking about. Go find it anywhere you find podcasts.
Listening to the podcast of the Archaeo Book Club, an online community for lovers of archaeology and books. Hello and welcome to episode one of the brand new Archaeo Book Club podcast, now hosted on the Archaeology Podcast Network. Woo-hoo. My name is Tilly and I'm here with my co-hosts Judith and Ash.
Hi.
Hello.
And in this Field Notes episode, we're talking about the June reading theme for the Archaeo Book Club, which was Under the Sea, which I'm not going to sing it. My first ever, I distinctly remember doing like some dance performance at primary school to Under the Sea. I really wish I could.
Do you have a video of that?
No, unfortunately not. I would definitely include it.
It's just everywhere.
It's so good though.
We can't afford to sing Under the Sea on this one.
We don't have the copyright. Hopefully everyone listening is now singing it in their heads. Anyway, first question of the day. Sorry, yes, professional. As you can tell, episode one and we're already floundering into... Floundering!
Oh, yes.
Ah, you did it. I did it. I'm just going to leave now.
Get out. Cool. I have to work
So first question of the day. Under the Sea. Is this a theme that you guys would often encounter in your archaeology, history, literature related studies and work? So is it something that you came across often? I mean, Judith, I imagine in medieval literature or sort of art history, it might not come up as often.
I was going to go in there with a resounding no.
There we go.
And then I had a really good think and I was like, yes, actually it is. It's just not something that I've never specialized in anything that is particularly maritime related. I have certainly studied some of the early literature texts that very much focus on the sea as a form of self-discovery and pilgrimage. So the voyage of St. Brendan, the seafarer, the wanderer, those are very much focused on seagoing and thinking about the sea and meditating on the untamed nature of the sea in terms of how people understood that at the time. So not kind of like in the post-Wordsworth way and the kind of more uncontrollable nature is frightening, but also good for the soul way. And then I had another think, and there's a lot of people in medieval history and beyond where we have to think a lot. I think medieval literature and history used to be much more insular and it would be very white European focused, but things have branched out a lot more and we need to think a lot more about connections and trade routes and economies, and all of that is much more global in the medieval period than I think used to be previously. It used to be very boxed in little boxes, and now there's a lot of people who work on trade routes, on voyages, on the way ships were built. And then I also had a little think more local to me, although certainly all over the UK, and ship graffiti in churches is a huge thing these days.
Cool.
And there's some up on the coast, although you don't just find it on the coast, it's all over inland and everything, but ship graffiti is a very popular form of medieval church graffiti, and there are some really exceptional examples near me that you can go and find on a pillar with a torch or a phone camera.
I thought even like a fire torch,
right?
Like, yeah, exactly. I was like, whoa. That's hardcore. Yeah,
they're really good fun. They're basically the equivalent in many ways. I mean, there are all sorts of reasons that they might be there, but they also a bit like if you think about children, like maybe drawing a Ferrari or something on a school, one of your ship is your kind of top-end supercar in many ways.
Well, you do get the Vikings doing that a lot as well. They often scribble the ship motifs everywhere.
It's sort of almost a form of prayer as well. Sort of, you know, in communities where
ships get me out of here.
they do. You know, they do occur well inland in the middle of Leicestershire and places like that as well. But yeah, they are quite interesting. They're sketchy, but they're distinctly ships, and you've got the rigging. I've got a picture of one with some gun ports showing and things like that.
Oh, that's cool. So, that's interesting that you say that even at like really inland places, they also have them. So they were clearly well known.
They are. I mean, it seems to be kind of like a universal thing people were picking up on and graffitiing on church furniture and church sort of fixtures and buildings and statues. But it seems to have just been a popular thing to do. But the main problem with it is medieval graffiti is really under-researched. And a lot of the looking for ship graffiti was done at churches at the coast. So I was like, oh, they're all at the coast. And then recently people have started to find them in places that are not near the coast.
Are they closer to like riverways, do you think, if they're inland?
Because maybe.
It makes sense if you have a little river ship coming down to give you your goods.
So trade generally, I think, you know, they're a symbol of trade and prosperity. So overall, but I think riverways, that's a really good thought. Actually.
Although surely on riverways, I mean, you wouldn't necessarily have one with like a cannon port.
Well, maybe not, no, but you could have maybe seen it as you were going along the river and you might come back. Yeah. Or you would definitely have ones with rigging though.
Yes.
All on the rivers.
And in Norfolk, we have, although it's silted up now, at least one riverway that was navigable very far up. And that's why Norwich is the way it is, because the River Yar would take ocean-going ships until quite late on. So,
you've got to think the size of the river too. I mean, the Clyde can fit like a cruise ship. Oh, my gosh, they go down all the time, But yeah, so, you know, you have a very large river, then, it makes sense. And then the tributaries.
It depends on the draft of your boat as well. So if you've got something that's like got a shallow draft for going up a river, you've got like the Vikings, you can
spoiler it.
Spoiler alert. What's next?
Foreshadowing.
Very bookish term, Judith.
So that, it's really fascinating. They're really good fun to go and find. And they're really accessible citizen history, because they were kind of done by everyday people, but they're easy for people to go and find if they've got a torch and a bit of patience. Look around their church and see what they can find.
There you go. We've got treasure hunt set up for people.
Treasure hunt.
So how about you, Ash? What's your experience with under the sea?
Very little, actually. Like, I wanted for a time when I was just leaving, like, my undergraduate, I fancied doing underwater archaeology. Mm-hmm. And I did have a look at all the courses and stuff. And then I went into commercial and I did the Hewitt training. And I realized, no, I'm never doing that, ever.
What's the Hewitt?
It's like underwater sea survival.
Oh, is helicopter. That the thing in the helicopter? Yeah. Oh, no.
And I know, I'm never doing it ever again. I did work with someone who was a diver and an archaeologist, but he had, I can't remember if it was the bends or he had like his ear, something wrong with his ear, and he couldn't dive anymore. But when I was thinking about like archaeology and seafaring, actually my brain kind of went the same way as Judith, strangely enough, even though we have different disciplines. Yes, because I'm from Northumberland, so the coastline is full of usually monasteries on tiny little islands, and you have to get to them via either sea or pilgrim walking ways, which then disappear underneath the sea. So that's what I was thinking of. But no, I don't have any other than like, you know, digging a site that was once beach site but now is inland. You get that quite a lot in Scotland, especially Mesolithic and Neolithic, and even into the Bronze Age you get sites that are really sandy sites and were once on the beach but are not. And so you get the people moving around in that kind of nomadic way, or going between different settlements for summer and winter and things like that. And so the occasional midden and burial on a very sandy beach site, I've done that. But other than that, not much.
No, fair. Yeah. I actually also wanted to be an underwater archaeologist.
And I think you do much better.
Well, so my dad was a diving instructor. So I got all of his gear when I went off to uni. I was like, I'm going to learn scuba diving because they did that at Aberdeen Uni, which is where I did my undergrad. Yeah. And so I went and I took all his gear and I got myself a dry suit and I learned how to scuba dive. And I am now a qualified, not classified.
I am classified.
Who do you work for? Well, wouldn't you? One of my other jobs, yeah. No, I am a qualified sports diver with the British Scuba Sub-Aquapark. Oh, wow.
So do you have to keep that up? Do you have to retrain? Or
I don't have to retrain, but I need to have like a certain number of hours recently, which I don't have at the moment. So
flying in a plane kind of thing. So you need to prove that you've logged the hours in.
Yeah, exactly. So if I would want to do it like properly, I'd definitely have to like go on a bunch of just fun dives again. in order to get my hours back up. But, and I might have to do, depending on how long it's been, I think I might have to just do like a refresher, like qualification thing. But yeah, all of the stuff, I mean, you're taught, you know, you have to do the whole taking off your mask, taking out your regulator, breathing thing.
Oh yeah.
All that kind of stuff.
Rebreather.
I don't have that. I had just a normal regulator. So just the thing.
Give me.
Well, so this is a funny thing. I had like a whole freak out at some point. I love swimming. I've swum since I was very little. I've been a professional swimmer.
You're an absolute water baby, aren't you?
Yeah, exactly. So I've always been very comfortable in the water, but it turns out that under the water, I wasn't quite so comfortable because I'm very claustrophobic. And it's really weird, but because you're in the middle of the sea, so you'd think you wouldn't get claustrophobic because, as you know, that wasn't the problem. The problem was the sort of feeling of, I don't know what it was, but I was completely fine for the first couple of months. And then at some point I just had a freak out and it took me like 3 months to get back in the water, which was...
No, I can see that. I think that would make me claustrophobic. I mean, I love snorkeling. Yeah. I'm not a great swimmer, but I really love snorkeling. But actually going right under in that way, I can see that I would feel...
It's the pressure, I think. There's like a pressure on your chest when you're going under the sea. And I just
Okay if you do it like if you do it slow enough. But for me, it was it's the you know, you get a little bit of water in your mask and then you can't see properly. And then it's like a whole, I don't know, it was like a whole thing. But I got through it. Yay. And I managed to qualify, which is great. And I really enjoyed it like towards the end. I haven't done it for years now, which is a shame. But the favorite ever dive that I did was a shipwreck dive off the west coast of Scotland near Oban. I can't now remember actually which shipwreck it was, unfortunately.
I just love that you went into such a Scottish accent then when you said,
did I?
Really did. Oban.
I hate
heard you say Oban like that.
It was a bonnie dive, that one.
Just throw some Doric and then you're done,
right? I cannot tell you how good it was. Anyway, yes, for those listening, I am Scottish by birth, but not
by background.
Yeah,
that's Tilly's true accent.
Yes, I just put it on. When as soon as we stop recording, I'm going, oh, Felly, that was good with it. Anyway, we're being professional here, ladies.
Obviously.
Yeah, it was.
Anyway, it was a very cool shipwreck dive and I loved it so much and it was amazing. And what was the best part about it was that was also the day. So we had like various different dives that you had to do to qualify. And one of the dives you have to do is you lead the dive. So rather than your like instructor leading it and then you having to do like all these different things throughout, you actually like are in charge of the dive. So you have to check up on the air of your instructor and you have to make sure they're okay enough times and you have to like check their air and they'll usually do something stupid. You know, they'll usually like put too much air in and then go flying up. And you have to bring them down, you know, like that's sort of basically to check that you're like can be calm and in control, you know, underwater. And one of the things is you have to like do the route. And everyone else who did it, because I'd had my freak out, it took me a couple of extra days because the first couple of days they wanted to just make sure that I definitely was okay. So I was just doing like fun dives, but everyone else had started doing the qualifications.
The serious ones.
Yes, exactly. And so then I started doing my serious ones a couple of days after everyone had started, but that meant that all the different sites that we went to, I was kind of a day or two behind everyone else. So by the time we got to the shipwreck, everyone else had already done all of their ones. And the last one you do is this leading the dive. And most people had done it at this like big sea lock that we were at. And you have to like find, you have to come back to the same spot. So you go down and then you go off for a little dive and then you've got your compass and everything, you know, and the point is you have to find the spot where you started. And that's like part of the qualification, which of course everyone, you know, got not completely lost. Like some people got more lost than others. One guy ended up like on the other, complete other side of the bay. And, you know, like, of course it's difficult. You've got like 2 meters visibility, right? Like it's not that easy. but I did mine on a shipwreck. It's quite easy to find your way back to the start when you just have to literally go up one side of a shipwreck, go on the other side, and come back on the same side. So I got like,
I guess it must be like when I used to mountaineer years ago, and it was a terrible navigator. But one of the things we say is like, if you end up in a really big area of forest and you're lost, that's the worst, because if it's just trees,
yeah,
getting, and there's more trees and then some more trees after that, then getting your bearings is actually really difficult.
Oh, it's super difficult. Yeah. So you have to like really watch like how far you're going, what your pace is, like how long you've been going one direction. So yeah, I had it very easy because I could just do it on a shipwreck. But anyway, that's
my rule. Just in the swimming pool when we did Hewitt and I was still lost. Like,
oh my God, where am I?
I was like, oh, I'm upside down. Yeah, I hated it.
Oh, no, it was good. I wouldn't mind doing it again, but it's like I say, it's been a while, so I'd probably have to do a bit of remembering when I go back. But yes, but no, underwater archaeology is definitely something I always really loved, but I've never done proper sort of underwater archaeology. The excavations that I did in the Arctic were like right next to the sea, but they were sort of, yeah, very different sites. I think for me, it's more, I think of things like Doggerland and kind of underwater landscapes. So that's kind of the first thing that springs to mind, I guess, for me, because I'm not a field archaeologist, like Ash, so I don't have that kind of, more of that lived experience, I guess. So yeah, that's my little overview. Let's have a very quick break and then we'll be back to dig more into the details of this theme. And we're back. So we talked about our own kind of experiences and sort of favorite parts of this theme, but what about its more, I guess, general, broader importance? So do you think it's sort of, I guess, relevant or valuable or important topic to focus on? I mean, you already mentioned, Judith, in the last half that it's actually part of an improvement almost in the discipline of kind of medieval literature and English literature, because it's forcing people to expand.
Yeah, I wouldn't say improvement. I'm probably, because that was never my original, I was very land-based and very narrow.
A landlubber.
It probably didn't really impinge on me, but I was actually did a really quick skim of some of the academic presses that sort of have a lot of medieval stuff last night. And there's definitely, compared to what I remember back in the day when in my misspent youth, there seems to be a much greater spread of literature on studies and things that are bringing in all sorts of aspects of international travel. Obviously, the sea was kind of one of the main ways of doing that. And indeed, during that period of my life that we do not mention, I was studying a pilgrimage itinerary. And although that was mostly overland, that the sea was involved, because you kind of difficult to get to Jerusalem without ever going by boat at any point. Yeah. So, and also they travel down the River Po in Italy in my pilgrimage thing, and it had the most wonderful thing. I know this isn't what it was really said in medieval, but it actually said in the, if you read it literally, and then we come down the River of Poo and we come to Venice and it standeth all in the sea. I always particularly remember that.
Lovely. Oh, there you go.
In archaeology, you do
without a paddle.
To be honest though, even in archaeology you encounter so much poo. Like,
yeah, there's I was like, what, the river of what? Oh, that.
The river of shit.
It is a thing. I was just kind of out of the loop, but it does seem to be an increase, and there's a greater interest in all kind of aspects of things to do with the ship, but less under the sea, more on top of it or by it or using it for some purpose.
Although this was actually something that I realised after I said it, I did under the sea. It was basically every time we think a theme, I always try to make it slightly more, I don't know, poetic, I guess, rather than just being like sea or, you know, water or something. So I was like, oh, I'll link it to this well-known popular Disney tune and call it Under the Sea. And then, a couple of people also mentioned the same thing, being like, oh, but this isn't really under the sea though. And I was going, oh, damn it. Yeah, it was too specific. So I need to make sure to be more general next time, I guess.
Especially, because it was mudlarking, wasn't it, that we really focused
Which is technically under the sea. Under the river, underwater.
Underwater.
Might have been under the sea at some point, I guess.
Yeah. Well, and that's actually something that was very interesting. So I also did a course on maritime archaeology during my master's. And one of the big questions in like lecture one was, okay, how would you define maritime archaeology? Like, is it everything to do with water? Is it just stuff that's to do with the sea and the ocean? Is it also stuff to do with river? And it's sort of, that's why there's this distinction between underwater archaeology and maritime archaeology, but then maritime archaeology also, a lot of people associate it more with like boats and ships and, you know, seafaring ways. But then you also have like riverways that maybe weren't to do with this, with ships, but had some relationship to them in some way. You know, like if you're studying a canoe, is that maritime archaeology, or is that something? It was a really interesting discussion that we had about it, actually, about like,
yeah,
okay,
and that actually ties into a paper I saw given a couple of years ago, and Ash mentioned about rivers, but there's an argument that in medieval Wales, the transmission of the cult of early saints, previously people have said, oh well, it's to do with like extant roadways, of which there were not many was, but there's actually an argument to say that the cult of saints traveled down river channels rather than via a conventional road, and there were a paper given where there were lots of sort of diagrams of river catchments and watersheds and looking at where foundations of different saints' names were, and there did seem to be a correlation at least between sort of river systems and where certain sort of cults had really kind of established themselves. So
Yeah, so I guess it's the study of the knowledge of waterways and kind of how that works would have then been an essential part of that research.
I think we tend to look at rivers now as well and go, oh, it has to be a big river to travel along, but people outside them, or something like a coracle, you don't necessarily need to have.
I love coracles.
And there's portage, of course. You can lift out a light boat like that and walk for a distance and then, you know, as demonstrated in The Lord of the Rings.
Well-known fiction, non-fiction depiction.
I think that's the wrong podcast. Hang on.
Yeah, the wrong podcast. But yeah, and again, I recently read Is a River Alive? And there's portage in that. So I think we tend to forget that's another method of travelling with water. It's like not always being in it, sometimes carrying your boat, sometimes putting it back in on the other side of the rapids.
Which coracle, for those unaware of what coracle is?
It's a tiny little leather boat that looks like a tiny bag. That's how I see it.
It's round.
It's round, yeah. If you want to find a really good example of it, Pictavia Leather online on Instagram. Yeah. Yes. He has a coracle.
There's a few people who specialise, aren't there, in not only making them, but how to use them correctly, because they're not straightforward to use.
There's actually in Timeline, the film, there's a coracle.
Yes,
Lady Claire is in the coracle. As what's Gerard Butler's character? What's his name? It's not like Aiden or something, is it?
Probably.
Merrick, that's it. Well done, Merrick. Merrick helps her go across the river divides the French and the English camps. There you go. Timeline.
Well, what a tie-in! Because
what a tie-in.
For those who don't know, one of our earliest.
Time travel? Was it not?
Was it time travel?
Did we not do it for like medieval? No,
that was Name of the Rose.
Name of the Rose. I cannot remember what we did.
Thriller or something? Adventure?
Well, it could have been a thriller, but it's not really.
Sci-fi.
That was Shadowy Horses we did.
That was Shadowy Horses.
And that's not sci-fi.
Oh my goodness. Well, ladies and gents listening in, and any other persuasions, we are well on top of things. We know exactly what we've read. We've been going for 3 years, to be fair.
There's quite a lot of books that we've read.
There's a lot of things. So, you know, we do 36 books to be precise, if we've been going for 3 years, I guess. So, you know, there you go. If anyone wants to find out when and where we read Timeline, you can go and check our Discord server and you'll be able to see that plus our ratings. There we go. That's why we didn't do it. It's supposed to be a teaser. It's not because we can't remember.
No, not at all.
It's episode one here, but it's episode 57. I don't know. For us.
Great. But yeah, so anyway, we were talking about coracles and somehow Gerard Butler came into the conversation.
As he should.
Always does, yes.
He always puts in that eye.
Speaking of lovely Scots people. But yeah, no, it's interesting because also with the study of kind of archaeology, I guess it's been so focused on, because so many of early people would have focused on riverways. And I guess you probably have more experience of this than I do, Ash, because you actually have dealt with the physical remnants of this. You were just talking about the sandy sites and things like that.
Yeah, I did work on a river as well, but it wasn't really, you can't really find context. And well, for what I was doing as a land-based archaeologist, finding contexts within a river is quite difficult. So I did find some bayonets. That was kind of cool. Someone had clearly chucked them and then they went into the river and then were found.
It's like, as in little, the pew.
Like, the ones that you, basically what you attach to a gun and it's a big knife.
And you shoot a knife out of it.
You don't shoot the knife out of it, it's attached to the knife.
Yeah, you strap it on.
You push it.
You strap it to the gun. So basically when you've done your shot and you need to reload, you can just stab someone instead.
There you go.
That's
for a really long time and isn't potentially that good a use of your... Yeah,
because if you've got a, you know, a, I just don't know what the gun's called. Sorry, it's completely out of my mind.
Yeah, I guess.
Kind of. It's like rifle, a 16th
pistol,
century.
That's all I know.
Yeah, like, think of like Civil War in the UK kind of thing. So like if you've shot your shot and then someone's coming at you and you've missed them because you would have, because it would have... you know, wide.
Trooper training.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like actually doing the gun motion as well, but you can't see that, so never mind. But,
picture it.
Yeah, you can picture me holding a gun. And then, yeah, so if they're coming into close combat with you, then you can just stab them in the shoulder or in the leg and then move on to the next one, hopefully get a bit where you can sit and you can put your pellet back in and then again. Yeah.
I genuinely thought that you shot the thing, which is silly because I've watched like Sharp and things, like you'd think
think of Sharp,
right? Sharp uses bayonets.
We used to get demonstrations. I used to live near Selgrave Manor, which is where George Washington's family came from when I was a kid. Ooh. And they did lots of Civil War demonstrations there, including how to cast bullets and then firing and then put a strapping on a bayonet, basically, or using a gun in a different way. So I have seen it done.
Sort of, they would fire the gun and then they would put the blade on. It's not that the blade's already on.
No,
there.
The blade's already on.
Oh, the blade is already
on. Yeah, in some cases. But some of them you can remove it. It depends on your gun.
Removable. Yeah, and you can be like...
Early pen knife.
Early pen gun. If you need to, like, sword cut gun. A piece of cheese. Well, you've got a gun.
Shoot your chicken and then cut it.
Yeah. Yeah, sorry,
we've
that. Anyway.
We've got shopping.
But I was also thinking as well of, you know, if we're talking about, you know, has the study of maritime or underwater archaeology changed? And I would say it has, and especially... There was lots of different Northumbrian and kind of Yorkshire stuff going on recently. When I say recently, it's probably like 6 years ago, but I know that there is like Pascoe Archaeology. They're based in the Northeast and they do a lot of underwater archaeology in the UK and they do maritime stuff. So they do a lot of shipwrecks and they've been commissioned by like Historic England and stuff to do a lot of surveying around these wrecks and around the coast. Mm. But then you also have York, University of York, who look at the prehistoric landscape that is underneath the water, which is really fascinating because obviously you have all these types of stuff. You have like Seahenge and these monuments that have disappeared, and you also have lots of settlements that have disappeared because especially when you're looking at the Mesolithic, you had the Storegga slide, which was like a huge underwater earthquake and basically caused a lot of disruption because there was tsunamis across the coasts of pretty much everywhere, hit everywhere. So I always think about these people like in the Mesolithic in Caithness, like at the top of Scotland, just sitting there on a beach, and then suddenly this massive wave would have come at them. Mm. And what would you have done? You know, and all of that kind of archaeology is gone or is now under the sea. So yeah, there's lots of stuff like that.
Seahenge is really near me. And when you can visit the beach, I haven't been to see the reconstruction of the museum in Kingsland, I do confess, but one of our friends is an expert in coastals. I couldn't tell you exactly what Professor Tolhurst does, even
sorry, Professor Tolhurst.
He's an expert on kind of coastal things and silt and erosion and coastal deposition patterns and tidal things. And talking to him about the kind of ecology around the area of Seahenge, and you can still see the kind of the peat bed that it was in. If you go for a walk on the beach, that the remains are there. For some reason, my dog goes mad at it. It loves the smell of that kind of peat bed. That's like,
he's just an archaeologist at heart.
He's sensing the ancestors.
He's like, oh my God, yes, I was here in a past life.
It really gets him going if we go and walk up the fascinating place, because you go from kind of a typical sandy beach and then it is sandy and then there's this sponginess. If that makes sense. It's really interesting to see how it all changes up there as you go along, and you can see these kind of just the kind of, I guess you'd call it, medieval palimpsest of kind of.
Good word. Love that word.
Good word.
Yeah, no, palimpsest is the best word.
Yeah, it's really interesting just to watch the way it changes. And yeah, one of my friends is very, like, in terms of modern ecology and conservation and global warming and erosion, he's kind of very, that's his kind of area of focus up
there. Good folks to have. Well, and indeed, I think that's one of the most important reasons why it's something that we need to keep studying and everything. Because also so many people, I think, who are not as familiar with archaeological landscapes or historic landscapes, you sort of assume, oh yeah, but it's always been like this. But no, it definitely hasn't. Like, it's changed so much.
And so even,
you know, yeah, the land bridge between Europe and the UK, known as Doggerland. I mean, honestly, if people are not familiar with this, who are listening, please look it up because it's so cool. There's so many
Or
cool
you can
things.
Listen to our episode.
True.
And My Trial.
And My Trial, which is another show that Ash and I have on the APN. Shameless self-promotion. But yeah, so you can find that and find out more about that. We chat with Sasha van der Vaart-Verschelf, who is an archaeologist.
There's some good books in Doggerland as well. That
There's
kind
great
of
books.
Yeah.
Yes, Sidestone Press really has an excellent book. Yeah, mm-hmm. We'll link that down in the show notes. But yeah, it's one of these things that you just, yeah, once you start to realize, okay, no, the landscape has changed so much. So how we see how people use this landscape and how people adapted to this landscape is something that's very, I think, relevant in the modern day when the landscape is also changing and the environment's also changing. So
rapidly as well. And yeah, that's why underwater archaeology, and especially when you're looking at erosion, things yes. like that, is so important, yeah, because we are losing sites that are in dunes that are being exposed,
yeah,
you know, in stuff like that. Places. So yeah, in coastal places. So we've got to be really aware of it, because if there's, you know, climate change affects all archaeology. Yeah. So we, yeah, it's yeah, huge. And I think it's just getting bigger. Every yeah, single, really every is. Single, yeah, you find more and more stuff that's being uncovered. Yeah.
My friend, Professor Tolhurst, is not an archaeologist. That's definitely what his, you know, looking at the kind of current day
yeah.
impact as well, and how it was and how it is and what his, you know, how we're looking at things shaping up in the future. That's very much what he does. So,
yeah. Perfect. Yeah, we should have him on. No, but indeed, I think, yeah. Well, I think we'll keep this short and sweet. If people want to find out more, do come and chat to us. Maybe we can start chatting about these kinds of things as well on our Discord server. That'll be fun. That about wraps it up for this episode. So next episode, we'll be continuing to chat about the theme of Under the Sea, but we'll be focusing specifically on our bookworm perspective, including a brief summary of our final pick, which was, as has already been kind of mentioned, Mudlarking by Lara Makelam, as well as some personalized recommendations of our own for further reading. So definitely tune in to get those top reading tips. If you want to find out more about the club, you're more than welcome to come along and chat with us. All of the links of how to join, as well as the reading list, any other links of interest are included in the show notes. So for now, happy reading and goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Archaeo Book Club podcast, produced by the APN. If you want to join the club or just get more information, check out our website at www.archaeobookclub.com.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.archpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.